If you're looking for a way to help birds or take your support to the next level, this May, I would love for you to join the Birds Canada Birdathon. It's easy to participate in and helps raise thousands of dollars for bird conservation. Learn more at birdscanada.org/birdathon. Now let's get to the episode. You're listening to The Warblers, a Birds Canada podcast. I'm Andrea Gress.
And I am Andres Jimenez.
Join us as we travel on common flight paths with our guests, gaining insights and inspiration from the world of birds and bird conservation in Canada. Hey, how's it going, Andres?
It's going well. It's going well. I'm quite happy to be back to this, which is our second season.
Yeah. Second season, start of the new year. I can't believe we've been going for like 6 months already with the podcast.
It's incredible that we have a second season to do and that it's been 6 months. Some facts for our listeners is that we have produced 14 episodes on the past 6 months. We've also produced 468 minutes of content. And yes, and so many people are listening. We're listened to in over 1,000 cities in like 150 countries.
Yeah, that's pretty unreal. I love stats. Like end of the year, you know, Spotify and all these different programs give out so many stats. And it's really fun getting them for the podcast too.
Yes, particular locations. I'm surprised that people in Abu Dhabi hear us and some other places and many small towns in Canada. So a big thank you to all of you listening from wherever you are.
Yeah, it's great having you guys on the ride with us.
Andrea, what can we expect? What can our listeners expect for the second season of The Warblers?
We've got some pretty special content coming featuring Canada's endangered species. Some of the ones that you maybe haven't even really heard of, ones that we don't necessarily know a lot about, and then some crowd favorites as well. I'm pretty excited to get into those.
Like piping plovers?
Piping plovers, of course, of course.
Are we finally having a piping plover episode?
Finally, we will have one this season. Really looking forward to that.
So, Andrea, what are the species that we're going to be talking about?
Oh man, there's so many. Like, obviously piping plover, but, you know, owls, we'll get into marbled murrelets. And, you know, I think we should leave some mystery and let people tune in and find out as we go.
Yes. Hopefully everyone is going to tune in for this new season that is going to bring you back the amazing authors and biologists and birders that came to the show last year and many more. We know that people have been really connecting with the stories, the personal stories of the people that have come to the podcast. So we're definitely going to double down on that. We've also bringing new sponsors and we want to take this opportunity to tell you a little bit about how we do sponsorships.
Yeah, I really like the couple of sponsors we've had so far because they are companies that are actually doing really good things for birds here in Canada and like helping us make an impact and hopefully helping you, our listeners, make an impact. So feather friendly, the decals for your window to prevent bird collisions actually work. And that's awesome. And same with birds and beans. Like bird-friendly certified coffee is actually something that helps migratory bird species.
Yeah, it's very important. When we were creating the podcast, it was clear that we needed sponsorships to continue the podcast going, getting the equipment, getting it done, getting it out there. But when we were confronting this idea, we had many discussions. And I remember Andrea saying, well, you know, if we're going to have some sponsors, I wanted to be sponsors that align with our ethical values. We didn't only find sponsors that align with our ethical values, but we wanted for each single spot that we would create to bring solutions to the challenges we have on everyday conservation of birds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we hope that, you know, learning about the sponsors and listening to each episode as well helps our listeners come up with solutions that they can do to help birds.
And it's important thing for the audience to know that when we find a sponsor and when we try to do a spot like the most recent one for birds and beans, we're trying for the spots to teach. We're trying for them to be fun. We're trying for them to be engaging. And so it takes us a while to make them. And the whole goal of them is that people can get something out of it and something that is valuable for them and for birds.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been fun. Gosh, I've gotten a lot of hilarious feedback about the birds and bean one. People like the slurping sound effect, apparently. So, you know, thank you. Thank you.
Which is, it's made by Andrea. I want everyone to know that doesn't come from a soundscape library. No, that was Andrea through and through.
Lots of fun. Lots of fun making them.
We have a new episode for today. What are we talking about today?
We are kind of looking back on the year of birding. What did 2021 bring us in the birding community, in the birding world?
Yes, and for that, we have two amazing people, birders and conservationists. We're talking with Yusuf Atia. He is in Richmond, British Columbia. He's going to tell you a lot more about himself. And we're also talking with Mike Burrell, one of the authors for the book Best Birding Places in Ontario. And they are going to tell us how the year was in birding for them, but also in Canada, what were the species that were different or that were moving more than usually? And also we want to ask them, what were the big good news that birds got on this 2021?
Mm-hmm. And hopefully we'll get some insights from them as to what the next year might bring.
Yeah, let's do it. We'll be right back. How do you like your coffee, Andrea? Cream? Sugar?
I like mine bird-friendly, certified.
Then I have just the brew for you. Birds and Beans coffee roasters only use beans from farmers who keep the native forest habitat intact, growing coffee in the shade of a variety of native trees.
That's good for migratory birds.
Good for everyone. This coffee is even certified by the Smithsonian Migratory Bird Center. It protects biodiversity, supports sustainable farming, and it's fur trade, and organic too.
Ah, not to mention delicious.
Deliciously bird-friendly. If any of our listeners also like their coffee bird-friendly certified, here's how to get it. Order online at birdsandbeans.ca/warblers. Make sure to use the /warblers because that means Birds and Beans will also donate 10% of the purchase price to support this podcast. You can also use the link on your podcast player.
Sounds great. Andreas, how about another cup?
Let's do it. Well, without further ado, let's welcome our guests for today. We have Yusuf, Atia, and Mike Burrell with us, and I think we should let them introduce themselves. Why don't we start with you, Yusuf? Tell us about you, and where are you calling in from today?
Yeah, I'm calling in from Richmond, BC, on the West Coast, just south of Vancouver. It's actually an urban area right in the middle of the Fraser River estuary, which is an incredibly productive place for birding, not just in Canada, but on a global scale. So I feel pretty fortunate to be where I am.
Yusuf, what do you do for a living?
So I work for Birds Canada. I coordinate a couple citizen science projects nationally. So the Christmas Bird Count and eBird Canada, along with a team of folks. And I also develop and maintain the Birds Canada website, among other things. So I'm a bit of a jack of all, master of none.
Yes, Yusuf is one of the masters behind our website, and he's such a key player for us to be able to do what we do. And now let's go to Mike. Mike, tell us about you, where you're calling from, and what do you do?
Yeah, I'm based out of Peterborough, Ontario. I've been a birder since I was a little kid. I've sort of dabbled in all sorts of birding-related community science projects. I actually worked for Birds Canada there for a little while, running the important bird area program, and I was involved with Christmas Bird Count and eBird program as well. While I was there, I continue doing a lot of volunteer work related to these community science projects. I coordinate eBird here in Ontario. I'm the Ontario regional editor for Christmas Bird Counts. For work, I work at the Ministry of Northern Development, Mines, Natural Resources, and Forestry as a zoologist, focus on rare species, especially birds. And through that role, I get to do some work on the Ontario Breeding Bird Atlas, the third version, which is running now, which I'm real thrilled about.
That's awesome. So this means that if I report a white-tailed kite in Peterborough, I will be getting an email from you.
Well, you know what? I don't do a lot of the actual reviewing anymore with eBird. I sort of make sure that the different areas are getting covered by other volunteers and sort of higher level stuff like that. But it used to be me, that's for sure. I was doing the whole province at once a long time ago, but there's just too much eBird activity now for one person. So there's a team of about 40 of us now.
That's unreal to think about how much eBird has changed and evolved over the years, and especially with all the increase in birders, right? That's got to be kind of exciting to see.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's great great because it's a big job, as you can imagine. I mean, there's a lot of eBird everywhere. Ontario alone, I think it's about a million per year. And so it's a lot of data to go through. And by spreading the load out amongst a bunch of volunteers, it makes it so it's more manageable, that's for sure.
I find it shocking that you just mentioned that there were 40 people working in Ontario eBird just as reviewers and gatherers of all the data and everything. I'm quite surprised about that.
Well, thanks for that intro, guys. It's kind of nice to know just how deeply involved in the birding community in Canada you guys are, both through your work experiences and volunteering and just personal interests, right? What would you consider is like your birding style? Like, how do you like to bird? Are you twitchers, you know?
I feel that we need to provide some clarity or some context for the new birders that are listening to us today. Can one of you guys define twitcher for me?
It comes from the British. You know, they're always coming up with stuff first, especially when it comes to enjoying nature and birds. I first heard the term twitcher as a teenager volunteering at Long Point Bird Observatory on Lake Erie in Ontario. And I met all these, you know, all these really intensive birders coming over from the UK and Belgium and France. And they all had these hilarious stories, and it was a whole nother world I didn't know existed. And so twitcher is this British term for somebody who chases rare birds, and where it originates is the idea that, you know, you hear about a rare bird and you just get so excited that you can't even control yourself. You start twitching. Like, it's just one of these reactions. You're just so excited. And
okay, so we know what a twitcher is now. Is a twitcher the same as a hardcore birder?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily.
Some hardcore birders take pride in just being very thorough and contributing to citizen science or community science. You don't necessarily have to be a hardcore birder to be a twitcher, and you don't necessarily have to be a twitcher or a lister to be hardcore. Like we said earlier, you know, it's whatever you want it to be. It can be all those things all at once as well.
Okay, then what would a lister be?
I think a lister is somebody who keeps track of their birds, whether it be on an annual basis, a life basis, you know, even monthly.
We're already getting at the heart of what makes birding so fun. I don't like to consider myself one, you know, sort of fit into one of those categories. Some people would say I'm a twitcher, and I am a twitcher some days. I love chasing rare birds, but at the same time, I can be pretty happy sitting in my backyard, staring at my feeder and you know, looking at the junco flock or seeing what I can get flying over. I really enjoy like the concept of patch birding and trying to see what you can find locally. Things like eBird and breeding bird atlases are really cool excuses to go and just explore. If I had to kind of give myself a label, it would be that I like to explore the world of nature through birds.
Yeah, it's kind of like scavenger hunting. You get out into the woods and see who's out there with you.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, the element of surprise, that's part of what makes finding rare birds really fun. But you can be pretty surprised, you know, with common birds doing things you've never seen before.
Oh, absolutely. Like, I consider myself more of a casual birder. I don't twitch. I don't go out of my way to find a specific bird that might have been reported somewhere or anything like that. I'm all about seeing just the birds that are around me and enjoying their interactions with each other or with other wildlife. For me, that's totally where it's at. What about yourself, Yusuf?
That's the beauty of birding. I mean, it can be all those things in the same day. Really, you can enjoy birds, you can chase birds, it can be whatever you really want it. You know, personally, I've dabbled a little bit in competitive birding. I know Mike has as well, you know, doing things like big days and fundraisers where you go chase bird all day. It's sort of like the Olympics of birding. And I also have been increasingly interested in taking ownership of my patch, really getting to know the birds close to me, and, you know, occasionally being seduced by the odd rarity vagrant that, you know, I've become a little more selective about the birds I chase, but I do go after a few birds on occasion.
Everyone that is into birds is going through their own journey. Our journeys evolve and change as we experience them.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, we've got all these labels like twitcher and lister and all sorts of labels. And realistically, nobody fits into one of those boxes. It's a huge spectrum. And just because I like to chase birds or, you know, have a bigger life list than somebody else, it doesn't mean that other person is any less of a birder. I heard Ken Kaufman once say something along the lines of the quality of somebody as a birder is really how interested they are in birds and how much they pay attention.
So we've got all these different types of birders. I think right now is a really exciting time because in the last couple of years, we've seen a huge influx in new birders, people who are kind of stuck at home and started to look around at their local patches or their backyard and started to notice birds for the first time and really got into it. You could almost say birds were like essential workers for a lot of us during the last couple of years. Do you guys think that that's had an impact on the species that were detected?
I think so. Yeah, I mean, birding has gone viral. Is it okay to say that? Is that how the kids use it these days?
Yeah, I think that works.
It's a really good thing. And seeing people like just take an interest, whether it's even picking up a camera and keeping track of what they're seeing, or just an interest, like you said, in birds in the yard, putting up a feeder. It's really caught on, and people are realizing you don't have to go far to achieve that feeling of discovery. If you've never really paid attention to birds and you just start, you're going to see a lot of new things that you didn't know were just outside your door. And that's really exciting. And I think people have found that excitement. And it's really caught on. It's really nice to see. And as far as people finding more birds, I mean, we talked about rarities. Having more people out there just increases the chances that we're going to see more birds and really helps for keeping track of birds. Some like influxes of birds and finding rare birds have all happened because there are just more of us out there now.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's been really amazing to see the growth, especially in the last couple of years during this pandemic. You can see the growth just in a thing like eBird. I think we're like, I know in Ontario, we were kind of, it felt like we were starting to plateau in terms of the growth, which was fine, but it just ramped right back up the last 2 years, like 30% growth year over year, the last 2 years in a row. And exactly what Yusuf said. You know, the more people out there looking, the more likely we are to find out about rare birds. You know, somebody stumbles across something, they might have no idea what it is, but they can take a picture now with the way digital photography is, so they can post it on eBird, they can post it on all these different social media channels, and it gets identified within seconds. And you know, and then a crowd of birders descends on it, sort of thing.
You mentioned, the advent of social media and technology, because I think that has a part to play with how much birding has caught on. It's become really accessible. The information is moving really fast. It's exciting. And I think that's part of it.
So eBird is a bit like the birder's social media, right? It's a platform where people report the species of birds they see, but it's so much more than that. It's a database that collects this information and makes it accessible. It's also used for identifying birds. It's many, many things. Mike and Yusuf, have we seen an increase on eBird? You mentioned that we have seen it, but how big is that increase? Is this more users, or is this more people submitting more lists, or as well, are we seeing more rarities being spotted because more people are birding?
Yeah, I mean, it's all of the above. There are more people who are birders who have been birding for a long time and have started like using eBird more. It's also new people who are new to birding and have picked up. So we're definitely seeing an increase in users all along the whole spectrum. And it's definitely resulting in us learning more about birds, whether that be rarities or just changes in bird distribution. And just finding more birds, increasing that data set, that eBird data set, making it more powerful, more records.
Yeah. And the great thing is with eBird and seeing it grow is it's a reciprocal relationship between the data in that are putting the information in, because the more information that's in there, it benefits researchers and conservationists because it can be used to track bird changes in bird status and distribution and abundance. But it's really powerful as a learning tool for birders to know, okay, this is when I should expect this species, or this is an area where this species typically shows up. And a lot of that information used to be recorded, has been recorded for, 100 years in a lot of places. But, up until 20 years ago when stuff started coming online, if you wanted to know about the history of a species in an area, you had to know the person who had those records in, a filing cabinet in their basement kind of thing.
Do you have any specific examples of a change, a species perhaps that you've noticed in your life that really stand out?
Oh man, how much time do you have? Yeah, I mean, like Yusuf said, neither him or I have been birding that long. I mean, lots of people have been birding longer than us. And it almost feels like we're in a completely different place than when we were kids. Like, you know, here in Ontario, really great example is red-bellied woodpecker. Red-bellied woodpecker, when I was a kid, I remember I did this take your kids to work day thing. So in grade eight. And I went to this outdoor ed center with a friend of my dad's who was the teacher there, Ted Chesky, if he's listening. And I remember being so excited to go down there because they had had a red-bellied woodpecker come into the feeder. This is just south of Cambridge. I was pretty bummed because I didn't get that red-bellied woodpecker. That was about 25 years ago, and I still needed red-bellied woodpecker for my life. And, you know, now when I go home to my parents in the Kitchener-Waterloo area, red-bellied woodpecker's like the most common woodpecker we see. It's incredible how fast some birds can change positively, like red-bellied woodpecker. But at the same time, you know, we see species that have completely disappeared in that same amount of time. You know, thinking of Christmas bird counts back in my home turf in the Kitchener-Waterloo area in my lifetime. American kestrel and ruff grouse have both basically become extirpated from that Christmas bird count circle, whereas they, you know, they were annual in, you know, double digits when I was a kid. So it goes both ways.
If you're wondering why we're talking with Mike and Yusuf today, this is why. Because they have been birding for a long time since they were kids. And even though they say they haven't been doing it for that long, they can remember the birds that were extirpated through the decades of birding that these guys have done. And that is remarkable. And that's one of the useful things of being out there constantly all the time. Because you go beyond identifying birds and creating a list towards understanding how these birds are changing. And then I have a note for red-headed woodpeckers. If you're listening to me and you can follow the example of red-bellied woodpeckers, I would really appreciate that because I haven't seen a red-headed woodpecker yet and I really would like to see one.
Yeah, well, that's one that's gone basically the opposite direction, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's sad and it makes it super hard to find. And as I understand it, red-headed woodpeckers need big cavities and old trees, and the old trees are not increasing in Ontario, right? They're kind of disappearing really, really fast. And that could be one of those reasons. And on that sense, I wanted to ask you, you've mentioned a lot about rarities. And I want to ask you, what is a rarity? And how do they get here? And why do we love them and find them so fascinating?
The most simple definition of a rarity is a bird or a species, individual bird that is not where it's supposed to be.
Give me a good example of that, Yusuf.
Well, one example that comes to mind is something that's happened in the past year, which is the discovery of a stellar sea eagle in North America. It first showed up in inland Alaska, and then it just popped down to Texas real quick. And then it came to Canada. It was found in New Brunswick near the border of Quebec, walked around the Gaspé Peninsula of Quebec for a little while, stopped in Nova Scotia. And I think it made its way down the eastern seaboard into Massachusetts and now back up north to Maine. So all that to say that this incredibly rare large eagle that is supposed to be found in eastern Russia, a very limited range, northern Japan, eastern Russia, parts of Korea, and is now found in East North America is like unheard of. It's insane to wrap your head around. And if that doesn't make you excited, then I don't know what would.
What on earth was going on with that bird? Any theories?
Well, we know that weather plays a big part in taking birds off course. If you get a storm, for example, that they're notorious for picking up birds and moving them around. Mike can speak to what happens in the in eastern North America when a hurricane or a tropical depression happens. A lot of birds from the south and further out in the ocean will sometimes get blown in inland. But there are some theories that some individual birds have a predisposition to wander a little bit. And sometimes that gets, you know, out of hand, I guess. Predisposition to wander might be a selection tool for, you know, expanding their range or something like that, you know, just being a little more adventurous. So some birds do that and some birds just get caught up in the weather.
Yeah, so it could be a sign of trouble or it could just be a unique individual. It's kind of interesting.
Sometimes it's sort of the precursor to colonization and range expansion. And sometimes, you know, a bird that's a vagrant or a rarity today, you know, 20 years from now might become established and might be a normal part of the birds in that area. But going back to your question, there was some pretty incredible dispersal events, rare bird eruptions even, last year. I know Yusuf's got a pretty interesting one from the West Coast and on the East Coast here, if you consider Ontario East Coast. We had a big eruption of razorbills. That's the sort of northern hemisphere version of like a penguin almost, except it can fly. And, you know, we in Ontario, we almost never see razorbills, maybe one every few years make it into Ontario coming up the St. Lawrence. Usually they don't make it really past Quebec City. But this fall, there was just a huge number. I was trying to count up the number on eBird. There's at least 20 different locations where razorbills were seen on Lake Ontario this fall. There was, you know, close to double digits in along the Ottawa River. Montreal had a whole bunch. So they just really made it up the St. Lawrence. And one of the theories that was floated was that there was food shortages in other parts of their range. And so they were, you know, fleeing poor conditions in one area and trying to find food in another.
The big story out on the West Coast is eruption or influx of short-tailed shearwaters. So I know you had a recent episode talking about seabirds and pelagics. And so shearwaters are true pelagics in every sense. You know, they're able to ingest salt water. They only need to come to land to nest. And so short-tailed shearwaters breed or nest in the waters south of Australia, in the South Pacific. And then during our summer, they come up to the ocean, the waters around Alaska. But this year, birders started to notice shearwaters showing up off the coast of Vancouver Island, and even within sheltered waters, sort of between Vancouver Island and the mainland of BC, so the Salish Sea, and like the Queen Charlotte Strait. And those waters, more protected waters, don't usually have these seabirds. They're usually further out. So this invasion is truly unprecedented. The numbers are off the charts, like more birds seen in the past year than have ever been recorded ever before off the west coast of BC here. So yeah, so it shows the importance of people paying attention, you know, having all these birders able to document these events. And as far as the short-tailed shearwaters go, we don't actually have a good explanation, but it likely has something to do with changes in atmospheric pressure, probably related to climate change, that are causing changes in where different temperatures of water are and the food availability.
So we had a big movement of razorbills. We had one from shearwaters. Yusuf, can you describe a short-tailed shearwater for us?
Sure. A short-tailed shearwater is what we call a tube nose. It's one of those true pelagic species related to albatrosses. So it's kind of smaller than the albatross, but looks like a little mini albatross. And it's larger than the, you know, storm petrels, for example. So it's about the size of a crow. It's an overall brown bird, and it looks very similar to another species called a sooty shearwater. And they're actually really difficult to tell apart. So when this eruption started, we were unsure if it was misidentified sooty shearwaters or actually short-tailed shearwaters. They're that similar. But it turns out they are short-tailed shearwaters. And, you know, having people able to take photos and document that better, we've been able to really document this totally insane, unprecedented event that's happening off the West Coast this year.
Okay, so I can see how this is noteworthy. Like, a lot many more individuals of a bird moving farther from their territory that they traditionally do. What other noteworthy movements happened on 2021 besides the razorbills, which I am so sad I didn't know about this. Like, I would have definitely gone and seen them. I'm finding it about that now, and I'm like,
yeah, I agree. If you don't know these birds, go Google them, and you'll agree. You'll be sad you missed out.
What other movements were noteworthy for this year?
Yeah, well, you can't talk about bird movements this past year without talking about winter finches and just the absolute super flight. I guess that was last winter now, but I mean, that trailed into 2021, and then we're off to another pretty big year for finches, I would say, this winter as well.
Is this the winter finch eruption for the ages I've heard about?
It's the thing that made it the winter finch eruption for the ages was that it was like every species of finch was involved. There's this awesome thing in North America called the winter finch forecast. It was done by Ron Pittaway from Ontario for a really long time. And then in the last couple of years, he passed that job on to Tyler Hoare, another Ontario birder. And so the winter finch forecast involves basically surveying birders and naturalists all over sort of the northern half of the continent and getting a handle on the food sources that these finches depend on in the winter.
And which are these foods?
Pine grosbeaks. They feed on some of the berry crops like mountain ash. And then red poles will feed on things like birch seeds, Some of them feed on maple keys and ash keys, like evening grosbeaks do. And then spruce and tamarack, pine. There's the crossbills and siskins are feeding on those, as well as eastern white cedar are some of the big ones. And so they pull all these naturalists and find out what's happening with those food sources. And then these birds are just have these amazing abilities to move across the continent east to west. They basically move back and forth around the boreal forest and in search of their food in the winter. And in years when there's sort of a synchronized failure of those food crops, which is a natural, you know, it's natural for these trees to produce food one year and not much the other year. It's a bit of a response to making sure the seed actually survives to turn into baby trees, basically. Some years they're good crops, some years they're not. And when it's synchronized that large chunks of North America have poor years for these crops, then the birds that depend on them will, you know, like white-winged crossbill might be entirely in Alaska one winter and then move over to, you know, the Maritimes and Newfoundland the next year, depending on where the food is. And so the big flight in the fall of 2020 was a result of basically every single one of those food crops failing. And so all these finch species of every species, evening grosbeaks, crossbills, red bulls, pine grosbeaks, everything came south in huge numbers. And so people got to see them in places where they don't normally get to see them.
Okay, so last year I saw my first white-winged crossbill, and I was so excited about it. But to give people context, Mike, what would it be the years in which we don't have them? Would we see any of them? Would they not be here at all?
Yeah, it depends on the year. So I would say on an average year, a few white-winged crossbills might make it into southern Ontario, southern Quebec, and, you know, the northeastern U.S. But some years there, like I said, some years the entire population of North American white-winged crossbills could be, you know, in northern Alberta and southern Yukon, and there might not be a single one in the east. And then it could be the complete opposite the next year. So it's really one of these things. And that's why it's so amazing that we have these winter finch forecasts to sort of prime us and get us ready to know, okay, yeah, this year it's going to be on. So let's get out there and watch for these birds coming south.
That's fascinating. This used to happen to me in Costa Rica, but with cedar waxwings, in which they were unpredictable. And there were 3-4 years where we would see none of them. And there were other years in which we would have 60 or 70 or 80 cedar waxwings, and then the whole country would go and see them.
Yeah, well, we do that for Bohemian waxwings, basically. It's very similar. They erupt.
Is this going to be a good year for Bohemian waxwings?
Well, it depends on your perspective. If you're a birder in, you know, southern Ontario, southern Quebec, then it's probably not a good year. But that just means there's good availability of food to the north, so they can stay further north and don't have to move as far in order to find enough food.
Experience as dramatic of a finch eruption in the west, in western North America, although we did get a huge influx of pine siskins to the extent that it was the most counted bird on the Christmas bird counts in British Columbia last season. So we didn't get the diversity of the east. We still had a finch eruption in the west as well.
It's so interesting to hear about some of these trends from you guys. Were there any species highlights from the past year? So I'm thinking like regional or national first-time birds, or any personal highlights maybe?
Well, I think Mike can speak best to the yellow-browed warbler that showed up in Ontario, which was, I think, the second for Canada.
Yeah, that was definitely a highlight, the yellow-browed warbler. And that's a great example of, you know, social media and birders being connected. It showed up kind of late April this year in Ontario near sort of Hamilton area, between Hamilton and Toronto. And like Yusuf said, it's only the second one ever for Canada. The first one was just a couple years ago in BC, I think. And this is a bird, again, of like Eastern Asia. It got posted on a birder site and kind of wondering, what is this bird? It looks pretty weird. And pretty quickly, people realized that it was something really good and worked out the ID. And a lot of birders were able to go get a chance to see it. And that's pretty high on the list of birds you didn't expect to get on the Ontario list. Anywhere in Canada or North America for that matter. And I mean, Yusuf already mentioned the Stellar Sea Eagle. That was another definite highlight for Canada, and pretty cool that it was able to so far be ticked off on three different provinces lists. We're still got our fingers crossed here in Ontario.
I'm starting to feel left out with the Sea Eagle, because I always expected it the first well-documented Canadian record to be found here on the West Coast, because we have, it's very closely related to bald eagles, and similar in habits. And we've got the highest number of bald eagles in Canada here, West Coast, year round. I saw close to 2,000 on a Christmas bird count here in the Vancouver area. So
wait, what? You saw 2,000 bald eagles on one Christmas bird count?
Yeah, we get huge numbers of bald eagles here on the West Coast. Most of those were at the dump. Bald eagles are really glorified scavengers. When it's easy, they go for garbage. And I have these pretty amazing photos of fence posts just lined up and just the ground littered with bald eagles at a garbage dump. I will be looking at every bald eagle very closely from now on, knowing that a stellar sea eagle can make it to Nova Scotia. This stellar sea eagle must have flown over British Columbia, Alberta, at some point to get to where it is now.
There were some other pretty amazing birds in 2021 as well. I wanted to mention a couple from Quebec. First one is the small-billed Alania, and that was found near Tadoussac in October, I think. And that's definitely in the sort of mind-blowing range of rarities, you know, something that you didn't really ever expect you'd be saying was just seen. It's a South American little flycatcher, you know, not too different from our least flycatchers and alder flycatchers. And then not too far away from there, there was a lesson seed eater, which is another South American bird. It was found right around the same time. There's, you know, questions about whether this was a cage bird that escaped, but there's definitely a case to be made for wild origin, especially showing up right around the same time that the small-billed Alania showed up.
Moving a little bit west to the interior, we had a Phainopepla in Saskatchewan. There's probably only, there are under five Canadian records of that species that typically occurs in the southwestern United States. It's really an arid desert species. It's a very cool looking bird, mostly black with these distinct white wing patches, and has this crazy punk crest. Like even crazier and more, you know, poofy than a, you know, a cardinal or a blue jay's crest. And it has this piercing red eye. So I'm sure Saskatchewan birders were pretty pleased to see that one last year.
I want to ask you, did you get any lifers this year? Because I assume that you must be struggling to find lifers. And for those that do not know what a lifer is, that means a new bird for a bird or one that they have not seen. I'm wondering if you had any lifers this year.
I did not have a lifer this past year, partly because I wasn't able to travel. There are 10,000 species of birds in the world. So anytime you leave Canada, there's a good chance you're going to get a lifer. And if you leave the continent, you're even better chance to find a lifer. But I did see a really great species that I'd only seen once before, which is a short-tailed albatross on a pelagic off the West Coast. So that was a highlight for me for sure. Not a lifer, but I got lifer looks at it, which means I got my best looks at a species that I had seen before.
Yeah, and I did get one lifer this year. Like Yusuf, it was a bit slim pickings because I didn't travel. I didn't leave the province. So a little trickier, but there was, I did see a Sprague's pipit. That was a lifer for me. It was one found by Jeff Carpenter and Peter Hogenberg. Jeff was doing a big year here in Ontario, and he was out in Rainy River, which is the little sliver of sort of prairie in northwestern Ontario, right on the Minnesota and Manitoba border. And they found a Sprague's pipit that was displaying. This was in sort of mid-June. You know, that's like a 30-hour car ride from Peterborough. So it's not something that I would just go drive for, even though it was a pretty exciting bird. But as well, I didn't drive there.
That is twitching.
It just so happened I was like an hour away for work. I was doing these aerial surveys, and I had, you know, 2 hours the next morning to zip out and try to see the Sprague's pipit. As luck would have it, I got there and was able to enjoy the Sprague's pipit singing, doing its amazing display flight. It's a bird of the prairies, and even, you know, it looked like it was on the prairies in this little pasture. Got the Sprague's pipit, and then on my way back to catch my plane, the birder I was with, Ethan, him and I found a lark bunting, which is another pretty rare bird in Ontario. I'd only seen two before. So it really felt like we were on the prairies that little morning in June in northwestern Ontario.
Wow, right place, right time, hey? It sounds like it was meant to be.
It felt like that for sure. I was pretty excited.
Have either of you ever found a rarity yourselves? Like you were the first ones to spot it?
Yeah. Yeah, I've been lucky to find a few pretty rare things here in Ontario. My absolute favorite rarity story was about a decade ago. It was 2013, and my wife and I were driving along the north shore of Lake Erie from Rondo Provincial Park to Point Pelee. And that stretch, Yusuf will know it, the highway goes right along the lake. And we were just driving along. I wasn't expecting to see something. I see this bird up ahead. Can't tell what it is. I get a little closer and, you know, I realize, holy crap, a swallow-tailed kite kind of appears overhead. I practically like ditched our car. I was so excited. I was shaking. You know, I got those twitches. My wife, Erica, she phoned my brother who was birding down at Point Pelee, phoned him to tell him. He jumped in his car to race towards us. The swallow-tailed kite started heading west towards Point Pelee. So we got back in the car and we started following it. And Erica was sending updates to the Aunt Birds, which is this email list serve for rarities in Ontario. Erica's posting these updates, you know, where we are, how fast we're driving. You know, at the same time, people are starting to assemble down at Point Pelee in the big parking lot there because it's got a good view of the sky. Birds of prey have this tendency to not want to go over water. So they kind of get funneled down Point Pelee as they get into southwestern Ontario. And the best vantage is this parking lot at the visitor center. So people are starting to assemble there. We're following this bird. And eventually, you know, this crowd of, I'm told, like 100 people had assembled. Sure enough, this swallow-tailed kite crested over the trees and flew directly over this crowd of people. And, you know, everybody's laughing and smiling, taking pictures. Everybody's pretty excited. And then a few minutes later, we pulled in and everybody's kind of like laughing about the situation, how cool it was.
You painted that story so well. I was picturing like that old movie Twister where they're chasing tornadoes and like the energy and the excitement of it, but then with a much less terrifying ending. Just, you know, really, really wonderful.
It was a pretty awesome experience. And, I mean, part of what made it so fun was to get to share it with so many other people. An aspect of birding that I don't think gets enough focus, the sort of community nature of it.
Yeah, real quick, my most memorable rarity finding was one actually when I was quite young. It might have been my first rare bird, and it was a scissor-tailed flycatcher in Calgary at the Inglewood Bird Sanctuary in Calgary. And it was a spring migration day. There were a lot of birds around, and you know, this flock, a harmless flock of kingbirds flies over, and within it was this long-tailed bird that all of a sudden just split its tail. If you've ever seen a scissor-tailed flycatcher, you'll know what I'm talking about. It just all of a sudden, the tail opens up, and it's like no question as to what it is. You know, a little bit of salmon coloration on the sides. And it was just me and this one other lady standing there seeing this happen, and the flock moved on. Unlike Mike's story, where other people actually got onto the bird, we were the only two people to see this. I'm really glad she was there because I'm pretty sure nobody would have believed me. I was pretty young at the time as well. Yeah, that's my most memorable rarity. And it's funny that still is my most memorable one because it was probably one of my first.
And that is especially a memorable moment because that bird, when I've seen it, it's been in the dry forest of Costa Rica. So good on you. And I find it cool that both of the species you mentioned are quite tropical.
And have crazy pointy tails.
Yeah, they both have crazy pointy tails.
It's fun to find rare birds, but often, you know, like we were talking earlier, it could be a gull, which, you know, looks similar to a lot of other gulls, or it's a flycatcher that looks similar to other flycatchers. So when it's one of these amazingly beautiful or such distinctive species like scissor-tailed flycatcher or swallow-tailed kite, it just sort of adds to the excitement for sure.
Well, those have all been wonderful stories. But looking forward as we go into 2022, what do you think we can expect from the birds and birding culture?
I think we can expect more birders. I've been happy to see the uptake in birding. I've been happy to see that it's gone beyond the typical, you know, demographic of older people. I've seen lots of young folks get into it, which is amazing. You know, they're the next generation. And I've seen different faces. It's become more diverse. It's become many, you know, naturalist groups, organizations have acknowledged that there's a lack of diversity in birding traditionally, and to make sure everyone feels included, promote more diversity. So seeing that is a great thing. And I think we're going to see more of that. And I'm excited to see how that affects birding culture as well.
Yeah, that's well put, Yusuf. I was going to say similar things, that it's really amazing to see the growth just keep going in birding and the interest. And there's been a lot of sort of reckoning with the lack of diversity there has been for a long time in birding. There's a lot of groups and people working really hard to try to make it a more inclusive space for everybody. As the American Birding Association says, the most exciting flocks are the most diverse. And I think it's very similar with birding. It's only going to make it better. Some of the other things that are on the horizon, I think we're going to see more and more interest in the local birding, the patch birding, like we've talked about. And one of the initiatives that I think is really cool that it kind of feeds back to diversity and inclusion aspect is the Bird Names for Birds initiative. You know, it's little things like names that can go a long way to recognizing the lack of diversity and moving beyond it and sort of trying to improve what I think is already an amazing hobby.
I'm glad you mentioned that patch birding has increased, and I'd almost go as far as to, you know, put a call to action for those who haven't really been paying as much attention as they could to areas close to them. Put an effort into spending one day a week or so at your local patch. You'll be surprised at how rewarding it is, whether it's just little discoveries of things that you didn't expect to find close to home, or, you know, happening on that big mega rarity. You know, that's how a lot of these rare birds that we talked about weren't found at popular birding spots where people were just paying attention to birds or took photos and found them, you know. Rarities show up everywhere, so you might be rewarded by paying attention to what's close to home.
That is some really excellent advice. Do you have any more advice for new birders or maybe the skilled birders amongst us?
I'd like to see, you know, those who do have experience continue to be open about sharing their knowledge. If you see somebody who looks like they're a new birder, you know, just say hi, you know, ask them what they're seeing, offer some advice, perhaps, and just try to remember that the community aspect of it is important. And now that things are opening up in the world and it's okay to talk to people again, let's do more of that and just be nice to each other out there.
Yeah, my personal hope, the one thing I expect to see more of for the coming year, and it's aligned with the advice you're giving, is that we can get together again for birding. I feel that when I started birding more, we kind of went into the pandemic and I missed on this community aspect that Mike was referring to. And I hope that we can get together again to do birding. It feels like it's been quite isolated, and I'm not complaining. It's awesome that we have it and that we can go out and see birds and still share online. But it would be nice to see communities coming together again.
Yeah, I agree. I look forward to doing field trips again and, you know, birding in a group. I love birding on my own, but it's something really fun about seeing the excitement of everybody and sharing that excitement with everybody. And the thing is, there's this huge new group of birders who haven't gotten to experience that community aspect so much. Yeah, hopefully we can start to enjoy that really soon.
Well, thank you so much, Mike and Yusuf. You've really given us some awesome highlights from the last year, and I've learned a lot, and I feel like I could sit here for another hour and hear some of these epic bird stories you've got, but we can't go on forever. So thank you so much for joining and sharing, and I look so forward to the coming year.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. And as you say goodbye, can you tell the people that are listening where they can find you or reach out to you, or where they can find information about rarities and deepen their exploration?
Thanks so much for having us. It's been a real pleasure to be on the podcast. I'm a big fan. If people want to reach out to me, I'm on Twitter, just Mike B.A. Burrell. I'm on Facebook as well. And you can find me on eBird. If you can find my profile, you know, look in Ontario for some sightings around Peterborough, you might find me, and you can click on my name. There's my profile. You can get my contact details there. I always love chatting birds with anybody.
Yeah, thank you so much, Andreas and Andrea, and congratulations on the success of the podcast. I've really enjoyed listening to the other episodes. And yeah, you can find me also all the major social media channels. YS Etia is my handle, or Biophilia, Biophylia. I also have an eBird profile. So if you see that, feel free to click on it. And if you see me in the field, come and say hi.
Thank you so much for being with us, and keep on birding. The winter birding is getting exciting. Go out, get close to the water and find some birds.
The Warblers is produced by Andres Jimenez, Jody Allaire, Andrea Grest, Ruth Friendship Keller, and Kate Dolish. This episode was edited by Greg McLaughlin and engineered by Katie Zhang, with the music by Jose Mora and art by Alex Nico. Until next time, keep birding.